This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season. And Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code Sit Down when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus. Up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's a sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code Sit Down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy. Football's coming.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. Hope you're all having a great week, another day, another dollar, another week, another sit down. We are back. Summer is winding down, but as we always say, the mafia history talk continues to heat up. Whether summer ends or not, we are still going to be hot here on the show. Got another great one for you today. Got a great interview. And we're going to talk about one of the most violent, dangerous people in the history of the mafia and a guy that truly marched to the beat of his own drum. We're going to talk about Carmine Galante, who basically told the mob at one point to pretty much go fuck itself. And that was really his undoing. I'm excited for this one. As always, we are powered by the great folks at Thrive Fantasy. And I'll tell you, football is coming. Go check out Thrive Fantasy, the app. They got a huge $100,000 contest coming up for the start of football. Go download the app now. Get involved. Play with me. Play with other people. Thrive Fantasy. Let's welcome in our co-host. It's our great friend and consigliere, Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, another show, another week, another show. How you doing?
I'm great, brother. Can't wait to do it. I'm excited to talk about Carmine Galante. As you said, a guy that marched to the beat of his own drum. I don't know that there's a more appropriate description of the man. One of the legendary figures that we're going to talk about today. So I'm excited.
Yeah, a guy that I think when you are posed the question, hey, who do you want to kill somebody if you're in the mafia? A lot of people never mention Carmine, but truly a fascinating life. We'll talk about his very publicized death, how that went down, who was involved, and more. Before we do that, though, I want to get to a little news. There was some wild news that came out late last week, but this one actually popped up just this week. We had a death in the Gambino crime family, legendary racketeer. This guy probably is a top five, top 10 labor racketeer in the history of the mob. Anthony Scotto died. And if you know or are from New York, you know his daughter. She was a TV commentator. She's on one of the
Rosanna Scotto. Yeah, she's on Fox 5 right. In New York.
Yeah, Fox 5. There you go. This guy was a powerful guy. He had probably more political connections than really anybody. I know, obviously, if you go back to the life of Frank Costello, he was big with political stuff. But this guy became really powerful through his relationship with Carlo Gambino. Obviously, he had some connections after the fact, but he had connections really all the way back to his wife. His wife's uncle was actually Albert Anastasia. He then makes a relationship with Carlo after Carlo takes over. He gets inducted into the family and then basically takes his family in the Gambinos into the labor rackets. He was huge in the ILA. He then becomes very connected through political allies. And at one point, he donates a ton of money to Mario Cuomo. And I didn't know this about Anthony Scotto, but at one point, Jimmy Carter prospected him as a possible candidate for labor secretary, which is pretty incredible. He was obviously derailed because he ended up going to prison. But this guy was a real gentleman from anyone that knew him. He was not a violent guy. He was an earner. And he's a guy that had a lot of sway in the labor unions. Anthony Scotto passes away at 87. Really a, I guess you could say, one of these Ivy League mobsters, Blackjack.
That's a great way to put it, because like you said, his political connections were, I mean, unheard of in the mob, right? Like the Carter thing is crazy to think of, but it's true. He was also good friends with Robert Kennedy, which, as everyone knows who's interested in the mafia, RFK was a notorious enemy of the mafia, and yet he managed to befriend him. So Scotto was a guy who really kind of bucked the trend of you know, fighting the establishment, and he made a hell of a lot of money doing what he did.
Yeah, and keep in mind, I mean, when it comes to labor rackets, I mean, this guy was really powerful. At one point, he was the third highest position in the ILA, which is a 100,000 member union. This guy was incredibly powerful, and he really opened up new doors for the Gambino family. Labor racketeering became a very big business, and this guy was one of the people on the forefront of that. So obviously lived a long, long life, did some time, but ultimately lived a pretty interesting life. Anthony Scotto dead at 87. Some other news as well, and this will really lead us into our interview. There was a fascinating story, and we'll kind of hear the interview and then we'll come back. I did an interview with Larry McShane, who works at the New York Daily News. He's a great author. He's written some great books about Vincent Gigante and Ralph Natale. But he posed a story last week that Carmine the Snake Persico, who we did do an episode on, there is, quote, information that Carmine was a high echelon informant. And I really want to get to this interview because I really just went to the source. I went to the guy that wrote the article. He was the first to report it. And I strongly urge you to keep an open mind. We'll kind of come back and talk about it. But remember, Larry is a journalist. He poses stories that he gets. And I don't think this is his general opinion. But here we go. Larry McShane on the sit down as he talks about his very interesting Carmine Persico article. All right, joining the sit-down now is a great author. He's a great journalist. He's a great reporter. You can find his work at the New York Daily News. And you can also check out some of his books, one of which I've read. I'm going to order the other one, and I urge you to as well. He wrote a great book on Vincent Gigante titled The Chin. Obviously, we're big fans of The Chin here at the sit-down. And then also another book, Last Don Standing, on Ralph Natale, who I know well, being from the Philadelphia area. It's Larry McShane joining us. Larry, how are you? I know you've had a busy week. How are you doing this week?
I'm doing well, Jeff. Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
Yeah, good to hear from you. And, you know, obviously, you know, in the mob, in the mafia, there's not a ton of news. Obviously, the news most of the time is, you know, compassionate releases. And all of a sudden now, I mean, you're dealing, you know, every couple of months, we're dealing with deaths. A lot of these guys are passing away. One of the guys that passed away, obviously, in the last couple of years was Colombo boss Carmine Persico. We obviously heard about his much publicized trial. We even heard at one point that he was hobnobbing with Bernard Madoff and other people. But you broke a pretty fascinating story, I believe it was on Friday, about the possibility that he was an informant and rap for the FBI. And I really just kind of want to ask you, where was the nexus for that? Where did it all start? Tell me more about the article.
Yeah, of course, of course. It's funny you mentioned compassionate release. That's what this thing started with. Little Vic Arena, you know, whose side of the Colombos was famously involved in a war with the other side there that was led by the Persicos. His family is looking to get Vic out of jail on a compassionate release. And a part of their argument was that he went to jail to some degree because of the cooperation with the feds during the war in 1991 through 93 for control of the family. And in the course of mentioning that, they produced a 1971 document, which had Persico listed as a top echelon informant. The lawyer for their family, David Schoen, later said that two previous lawyers for Persico had indicated to him that that was correct. He also heard from a former Colombo family member who told him that was correct. And so it was just a small part in this application to try and get little Vic out of prison, but obviously it blew up into a big story.
You know, this is obviously fascinating to hear. I remember when I saw the headline, I was blown away because, look, Carmen Persico obviously died in prison. He obviously died, I believe, in poor health in prison. He was in prison for a long time. And look, if you really look at Carmine's life, which I know you have, I mean, most of his time as boss was in prison. I mean, he was pretty unlucky really later in his life, but it was just so wild. I guess my question, my first question is, or second question, what do you say to the people that say, well, that's Greg Scarpa's ID number? Did you hear about that? What are your connections on that? Do you know anything about that?
We did hear about that. Again, you know, showing the lawyer who filed the document, produced, you know, I shouldn't say produced. He spoke with people in Washington before they went public with this, law enforcers who told him that he was right on this. And then subsequently, as I mentioned, he heard from some other people as well in the legal profession, and at least one guy in organized crime who told him that he was on the right path too. Now, I should add that there was immediate backlash from some angry folks, including two of Persico's lawyers. Can I swear on this show?
Of course.
All right. Matthew Mari, who was his lawyer for a long time, said the story was absolute bullshit. And I heard from another lawyer who, oddly enough, I had worked on a story about 2 years ago about how the government had kind of shut down his efforts to get compassionate release for Persico. So he and I had done this, like I said, in 2019. And he was also very insistent that these things in the court papers were inaccurate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's a several documents. Do you expect that, I mean, the feds will do more here as far as producing? I mean, they would have to produce 302s, no? I mean,
well, that's everybody says that. And I don't know what the deal was on 302s in 1971.
Right. No? True. That's true.
I'm old, but I'm not that old, Jeff.
I guess that's true. I guess when we really look back at like informants, I mean, we have to remember, and we've talked about this on our show with Gregory Scarpa, and he was one of the first real known informants. I mean, he started back obviously in the 60s, but as you said, I mean, there was probably a different process back then. I would have to imagine there would be some sort of proof of this, but obviously, I guess this is a last ditch effort by the Arena group. They're trying to get, you know, him out of prison. I mean, he's 87 years old. From what I understand, I'm sure you know, he's not in good health. I heard he's a little senile, if you will. I guess the big question is, will this work? Obviously, the government is not generous when it comes to giving people compassionate releases, particularly ones that were, you know, possibly or allegedly mafia individuals. We know with certain people, you know, Frank LoCascio was on the Gotti trial, you know, he's tried to get it. Peter Gotti tried to get it. Do you think this will work? I mean, I feel like this is a, and again, I want to also say there's a lot of people out there that want to belittle journalists for putting out information. Keep in mind, Larry, you're a reporter. You got this information, you put it out. That's how things work. I feel like in journalism now, people just knock the journalist because they put out the information. You put out a great story. This is a last-ditch effort by the Arena crew for getting him out. Do you think it'll be successful? And what do you think ultimately happens with all this?
Well, I mean, I think you made a an excellent point, Jeff, which is, you know, they're not the first family that's tried to do this. And Peter Gotti just got shot down recently. You know, the Persicos tried to do it for their patriarch and they were unsuccessful. So, you know, you never want to predict what the federal government is going to do or anything, but it seems like these prior cases indicate that it's a last ditch long shot effort.
Yeah, it definitely seems, you know, a bit out of left field, if you will. Yeah. Obviously, look, I'm not going to say that I'm a forefront expert on Carmine Persico. I think I know a good amount about him. He is one of those old school guys, okay? He lived through wars. He lived through a wild life. He was shot. He had all sorts of things happen to him. He always really struck me as the Salerno, Corallo, Castellano type that, you know, you're just in a box. You're just not going to get him to say very much. And I guess the ultimate thought is, if he was a cooperator, if he was someone that, you know, did all this, you know, why did he die in prison? Why did it get to that point? So I guess it's obviously, I think we'll wait for the next shoe to drop, but really an interesting story nonetheless. And obviously with the internet now, I'm sure there will be people that will try to unearth all this stuff. But the truth is, we have to kind of just wait for more shoes to drop. My thought is, Vic Arena will not get out of prison, and I think he'll die there, sadly, for his family. Quick, before we let you go, Larry, I always enjoy some of your books. You wrote a great book on the chin. Would you agree that, you know, and again, I mean, there are hundreds of people that we're going to do on our show and that people know about. Would you agree that Chin Gigante probably is the most fascinating individual in the history of the mob in America?
Before I answer that, I just want to say, Jeff, thanks for pointing out that story is not my opinion. It's being written off court papers.
Again, that's so important, and I'll let you get to the chin thing. That's so important because, you know, nowadays we have this medium where you can get on YouTube or you can get on Twitter, you can get on any of these sites, and you can literally say whatever you want. There are very few checks and balances for someone, and I think all of a sudden we've begun kind of just thinking that journalists are, and that's fair. I mean, obviously there's media that we don't like, and there's media that's definitely went downhill. There's not a lot of real journalists left, but, you know, again, this is not Larry's opinion. This is a story he was presented. He writes about mob things and he reported it. Okay. It's simply a report. It's not his opinion. So cut him.
Thanks, Jeff. And as for Chin, I always found him to be like the most fascinating guy of my time covering organized crime, which dates to the kind of early to mid 80s. You know, the whole crazy act and the fact that it worked for so long, which, you know, if you think about it, he took over in the early 80s and he wasn't convicted until I think the trial in 97. That's a long run in that era when the FBI had squads for every family. They were ramping up wiretapping, which, of course, brought down the Gambinos to a large degree. And, you know, there were other things about Chin. His priest was a brother. I mean, his brother was a priest. You know what I mean? So I just found him to be by far the most interesting guy. And I was fortunate enough that nobody else had done anything with him as far as a book.
Yeah, just really fascinating in all senses. I mean, he's a guy that, interestingly enough, I mean, really screwed up his first real big job as a mobster.
Yes, that's right. That's
you have
right.
to wonder, you know, look, I think in certain instances, he would have been killed probably for his misdeed there and screwing up. But obviously, he had a lot of connection to Vito Genovese, and we know what happened there. Real quick, you know, if you don't want to comment, I get it. His brother was recently in the news, as you're aware. The priest. Are you aware of that?
I wrote a story about it. Yeah. He was sued under the Child Victims Act and accused as a pedophile priest, Father Louis Gigante of the Bronx.
Who's now retired, as far as I know. I think
close to 90. And I had trouble, and actually I didn't have trouble. I just had no success in trying to track him down. To get some response to this stuff. So yeah, all I can tell you at this point is that somebody made an allegation and there has been no response.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely a lot of shoes to drop and a lot of stories. Final question. You made a comment, I think it was on this is, and I'll tell you, I do research on anybody I speak to. You did an interview with Steve Adubato a while ago. And did I hear correctly? You were at the Paul Castellano hit after the fact. Is that true?
Yeah, that's a true story. I was working, they call it a swing shift, like a 2 to 10 shift.
Yeah.
And, this is so long ago, the NYPD used to send out fax alerts on crime. So our fax machine went off, and the initial report was just two dead guys on the east side near a high-end vehicle, you know, a black town car, I believe, if memory serves me correct. And then the word had spread quickly down in the courts. We got a call from our guy at the courts that it was supposedly Castellano. And so I ran from our office in Rockefeller Center over to the scene. It might've been 5 or 6 blocks. And I remember it now. You know, it looked like you were walking onto a movie set, because the FBI and the NYPD arrived and they had set up large Klieg lights to kind of illuminate the scene. But of course, you know, instead of actors or extras or anything, it was all real people. And, you know, Bilotti and Castellano were lying in the street dead. And it was just crazy. Jim Fox, who was the head of the FBI at the time, New York FBI, me and another reporter saw him walking by. We grabbed him and he confirmed for us that, you know, yeah, that's who it is. It's Castellano and his driver, Tommy Bilotti.
I'd imagine Sparks, you know, they've never really leaned into it. I guess they could have said, we're the place that.
Yeah, no.
but I guess they have to be honest. Like that's had to have driven a ton of business over the years that, you know, that happened out front. Obviously it's a bad thing that happened, but I don't think you should do a piece on that. Get them to speak. I'd love to hear what they think about it. I don't know if you've ever tried, but, that's got to be an
interesting. Maybe I went back there the day after and hung out at the bar a little bit and got some stuff. Mm-hmm. But nothing recently. You know, I don't know that they'd want to go back and rehash it.
You know, Larry, I always wondered real quick. I always wondered about this. So we talked about Paul on our show. We did a show on him. And, you know, if you know about the hit and how it went down, we were actually very descriptive in how it went down. We kind of had all the shooters and everything. But a lot of people forget inside of Sparks, Jimmy Fiala was in Sparks, who was really the controller of the garbage industry for the Gambino family in New York at the time. And I'm always fascinated to wonder, what did he do during all this? Did he just scoot out and leave? What happened with Jimmy? I always wondered that.
I'm trying to think. There were a couple people who were inside with me, and they all just got out of Dodge.
Yeah, I always was fascinated by it. I wonder, you know, did he just like scoot out the front and get out of there or what? But
yeah, if you've never been there, you know, the entrance is right on 46th Street. So, yeah, right. I'm sure he just went right out the front door and probably the same way the shooters went east. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess it's pretty easy to get out of there before the cops got there. But what are you working on going forward, Larry? Do you have any books in the pipeline? Do you have any thoughts on anything? What do you have going on?
Yeah, no, things are kind of quiet. We're getting ramped up in New York for the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So I've been doing a lot of stuff on that.
Great. Well, we'll make sure we read you. We'll be interested in seeing where this Persco news goes. Follow Larry on Twitter at LM McShane, NYDN. Great reporter, great writer. Check out his books. I have, you should too. Go get the book on the chin, titled Chin, on Vincent Gigante. And last on standing on Ralph Natale. Real quick with Ralph, I know in Philadelphia he is not looked upon with a lot of grace. A lot of people hate Ralph Natale around this area. What's he like? I know he's a little prickly as far as I've noticed in interviews. You know, what was your experience like working, you know, did you work with him and what were your thoughts on him?
Yeah, he was great. I live, I don't know, maybe an hour north of Philadelphia. But we had an arrangement where I would come and meet him on Mondays and we would just sit and talk. And he answered all questions. He never pushed back on anything I asked. He has a great recall for detail. And, you know, we're still in touch years later. I call him every year on his birthday.
Interesting. Very cool. I'm sure you have a wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure we'll talk down the road about some of your experiences. I'd really just like to talk to you about really your life as a journalist. I think it's pretty fascinating. Very good. Larry McShane, great stuff. Go check out, again, like I said, his books, The Chin on Vincent Gigante, and Last on Standing on Ralph Natale. Go read the books. And that's, again, there's a lot of people that do not educate themselves. They try to rewrite history. Go read the books. Go read people that have spent a lot of time working and researching these people, and they're trying to put out entertainment and stuff that can educate you. It's how I learned, and it's how I think you can too. So again, don't hold Larry accountable for reports that come out. He just reports them. Larry McShane, thank you for coming on, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye, man.
All right, welcome back to The Sit Down. That was Larry McShane. You can find his work at the New York Daily News. And I would highly recommend, I have one of his books called Chin. Go check that book out. Very well done. The Life and Times of Vincent Gigante, one of our favorites here on the show. But Blackjack, a fascinating, interesting article. I will make this clear. I do not believe Carmine Persico was an informant. I think there were multiple reasons that he wasn't, first of which was that he was an old school guy. Being an informant was just not in his blood. And second of all, keep in mind, Carmine Persico died in prison, spent a long time in prison. And generally, when you cooperate, you do not go to prison and stay in prison. Keep in mind as well, as I said in the interview, the number written next to Carmine Persico's name as far as his CI number, that's actually Greg Scarpa's ID number. So I think the FBI has some explaining to do here.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think, and again, this is nothing against Larry McShane. He reports what he's given. I think that it just doesn't have the ring of truth to me. And the thing that really tips me, Jeff, is that Persico's attorney came out and vociferously denied this, which if he was lying, he wouldn't be able to do. I mean, he could lose his license over that. And you just don't make a deal with the federal government without your attorney. It doesn't happen. The federal government wouldn't cut a deal without your attorney there. It would be automatic misconduct. If you're represented by an attorney, they have to be there. So the lawyer would have to know about it, and he wouldn't be able to deny it the way he has. I just don't think there's any truth to this.
Yeah, there's still some shoes to drop here. But as you know, I think we can imagine, the family of Carmine Persico is not happy with this. Now, look, I don't think the FBI is going to make any grand inquisitions to a family of a mobster. I don't think they care wholeheartedly, but this is a weird story. This is not playing ball correctly. I don't know why they put this out. This is clearly, as we said in the article or in the interview, a clear, desperate attempt by Victor Arena, who's been in prison for a long time. We all know he hated Carmine Persico. They had a war for years against each other. He's trying to get out. Carmine is senile Uncle Junior type at this point, and I think he's just grasped for straws. And they said this just ended up being part of it. But I think it's really a sad way to defame Persico. Look, Persico wasn't an angel, as we know. He did some bad things. But the man died. Leave it at that. Why do we have to keep perpetrating?
Yeah, and Vic Arena is not getting out of prison. Like, he's delusional to think he's getting out of prison. I get you do whatever you can to try, but, like, he's not getting out.
Yeah, and listen, he's a very old man at this point. I think he just wants to die at home. But listen, you know, most of the FBI wants these folks to die in prison. And, you know, Victor Arena is on his way to that. We'll see what shoes drop here, but definitely a weird story nonetheless that we had to bring up. And look, we go to the source, okay? We don't just interview some random person. We go to the source. We go to the guy that wrote the article and say, hey, Larry. And by the way, Larry's a great guy. He retweets our stuff a lot of the time. And he's always done some really good things in the mob. So we thank him for coming on. What do you say we get into Lilo, Carmine Galanti? By the way, what does Lilo mean, Blackjack?
Cigar.
Yes, Lilo is Italian for cigar. If you know anything about Carmine, he like his one of his predecessors, Tony Salerno, they were big on cigars. The Italians are big on cigars, particularly mobsters. So let's get into it. Carmine Galanti on The Sit Down. Camilo Carmine Galanti was born February 21st, 1910, in Harlem, New York. His family was from Castellammare del Golfo in Sicily, and his parents emigrated 4 years before he was born in 1906. His father, Vincenzo, was a fisherman, and him and his wife obviously struggled to make ends meet. Like any immigrant family that settled in New York, work was hard to come by, but they did what they could to try to provide for their five children. Keep in mind, Carmine had two brothers and two sisters. Now, a little bit about Castellammare del Golfo. As you know, Blackjack, a beautiful little seaside resort in the northwestern part of Sicily. It's between Trapani and Palermo. And let me tell you something. It is picturesque. It's one of those places that you see on the background of your computer when you're away for too long. You know, those screensaver things. Just a beautiful place.
It is, yeah. I mean, you Google the pictures and you'll see it. It's one of those places with turquoise seas and the stereotypical Mediterranean villas. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous spot.
I think Carmine's parents truly believed growing up that they had a real behavioral problem on their hands. This is a kid that really acted out. By the age of 10, Carmine was a juvenile delinquent. And by 1924, he had been arrested three different times. At one point, people began to be so sick of him that they would send him to reform school to hopefully fix him, scare him straight, if you will. Didn't really work. By the age of 15, Carmine had joined a street gang in the Lower East Side and was really going around and robbing people and doing scores and trying to make any money that he could. He would try to keep odd jobs. At one point, he worked alongside his father as a fish sorter, and he would do other little knick-knack things, but it didn't work. Carmine would drop out of seventh grade and become an associate of the mafia. Keep in mind, in New York during the time, this was prohibition. This was a real money-making time, really, in all cities for the American mob. Prohibition was obviously very important. There was a lot of money in it. In 1925, at 15, Carmine would plead guilty to his first set of charges that were serious, and he would get 2.5 years in state prison. So Carmine, by the time he was 16, was a completely out of hand lunatic. He's a guy that his family couldn't control. He was out of school. He was running the streets amok. And I think his parents had really washed their hands of him.
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember the time frame too. This is 1925. We weren't arresting children at the rate we are today, right? Like today you've got cops in every school in the country. It wasn't quite the same thing back then. So for at 15 to get sentenced to 2.5 years in prison, that's a hell of a sentence for a 15-year-old. Even today, that's a hell of a sentence for a 15-year-old. So Carmine Galanti, when you say he was a behavioral problem, that is the absolute truth, because this guy was a problem from the time he was a little kid.
Carmine will get out of prison in 1929, and by 1930, he had developed a way to make money. Now, during this time, really in the 30s and 40s, we have to remember, this is right after the Great Depression. There are criminals popping up everywhere, and payroll robberies are very big. A payroll robbery is really a simple thing. It's a lot of the companies in New York at the time were getting large amounts of cash, and their employees would just line up and they'd pay them each week. That's how it worked. And a payroll robbery, you would obviously just go and rob the building of all the money. In 1930, Carmine and some of his cronies were starting to do those sorts of things. They were hijacking trucks. They were doing payroll holdups. And something happens. And this is really 1930, a wild time in Carmine's life. It's truly one of the more active, wild years of a mobster ever. And frankly, Carmine did something not once, but twice that no mobster's ever done. It's that simple. What happened was Carmine and his friends found out that in Brooklyn, there was a shoe company that had a factory and they had all sorts of workers. And every week they would pay out their employees. You know, at one point there was $100, $110,000 in cash on the table as far as today's times. Back then it was about $7,500. That was a lot of money back in those days. And Carmine and five men would pull up to this place. They'd force their way in and be taken to the sixth floor where all this was done. Now, as this was going on, this place was guarded by a NYPD officer called William De Castilla. Now, this guy obviously protects the money, and his job was to make sure everything went swimmingly. The problem was, once he gets up and they get up to the building, a gunfight ensues during all this. De Castilla was shot 3 times, 2 of which were in the chest, and he's killed. They make off and leave. Keep in mind, not $1 was touched out of the $7,500, which is very interesting. And I know, Blackjack, you would lend it to believe that this was probably just one of those things. Something bad happened, and you just wanted to get the fuck out of there.
Yeah, dude. I mean, you got to realize you're dealing with a 20-year-old kid here, right? Like, this is not a seasoned criminal at this point, even though he's done his fair share of stuff. It's a 20-year-old kid, and he's just shot a cop. So my thought process is he's probably thinking, oh, shit, this just went sideways. I got to get the fuck out of here in a hurry. So that's probably why the money wasn't taken. But for a 20-year-old to go into what he thinks is just going to be a robbery and wind up killing a cop, you probably want to get the hell out of there.
Keep in mind, there's no cameras, there's no DNA, there's really no nothing. And Carmine is never indicted for this. So a NYPD officer is dead. And there was not enough evidence to really bring anyone to justice for it. In 1930, late 1930, Christmas Eve for that matter, a truck is being boosted in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which is where Carmine lived at this point. And guess who it is? It's Carmine Galanti and his buddies trying to rob a truck. NYPD officer Joseph Minahan responds and catches them in the act. He gets them to try to stop. At that point, they start shooting at him. He returns fire. During all this, Galanti wounds Minahan. So he shoots another cop. And he also shoots, sadly, a 6-year-old bystander. Now, both people survived, including the cop. But this is where it all kind of comes out of the bottom for Carmine Galanti. However, he lucks out. For whatever reason, Carmine Galanti in 1931 pleads guilty to attempted robbery. For whatever reason, there's no attempted murder charge, even though a cop had been shot and for whatever reason, they were the only ones shooting. I don't know what the hell the state of New York was doing here with this. What the hell was up with this?
Jeff, this makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, I don't have to tell any of you listening. If you shoot a cop, okay, the cops are coming after you hard. Now, he killed a cop. Now he comes back a second time, shoots a cop and a 6-year-old, and he gets 12 years in prison, of which he only serves 9, and pleads to attempted robbery. I can't explain this. It's unfathomable to me how he was able to do this, other than somebody had to have greased the skids for him.
Well, listen, Blackjack.
It's inexplicable.
As they say, you can do a crime. They have to prove you did it, though. I don't know how they didn't really prove this because the guy was shot and they were the only ones there. But
I think they had to have gotten to someone because that's, I mean, you shoot a cop and a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
12 years.
Why do I get the feeling that if this happened today, Carmine would have got life for this for sure.
1,000%. Dude, you shoot a 6-year-old.
Right. Keep in mind, 1930 was a particularly violent year for police in New York City. 19 police officers would be shot. And 7 died. So this was definitely a more normal thing back then. Obviously, it was a lot easier to do crime and it was harder to get caught. There was a lot of things going nuts. Obviously, the Depression had just happened. So crime was probably out of control. But again, Carmine Galanti ends up shooting a cop, killing him, and then shooting another one. He ends up only getting 12 and a half years. Now, during Carmine's prison stay in 1931, he would go to Sing Sing Prison where prison doctors would diagnose him with some mental conditions. They would diagnose him with psychopathic personalities, and they would describe him as a dull individual with the mental acuity of a 14-year-old. So by now, he's 21. He's obviously got an immature brain still, but he had really acted like a young teenager. That's kind of where his head was. He only had what doctors would call a 90 IQ. He was, quote, very shy. He had no real common sense either. And he had no recollection of current events and or holidays. And it was called a neuropathic psychopathic personality. So while Carmine would prove down the road that he was actually quite good in business relationships and math and learning languages and all sorts of things, He was not a particularly book smart individual. And I know you know, Blackjack, that IQ things aren't everything. Obviously, I know a ton of really smart people that really can't get on in life because they have no social or common sense skills. So Carmine was smart for what he did for a living, but he wasn't any rocket scientist by any means. But this is definitely interesting information. And, you know, generally, you have some sort of common sense. Carmine had none of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on two interesting things there. The first is, you know, listen, I don't put a ton of faith in IQ tests, especially in 1930 or 1931, whatever it is. He clearly had some intelligence. There's different types of intelligence. The guy wasn't stupid. But the more important thing is the psychopathic personality to me, because that describes Carmine Galanti to a fucking T. I mean, if this dude, as you'll see in this episode, was not a psychopath, I don't know what the word means.
Yeah, and then when you look back on these tests, I mean, they were pretty damn true, frankly. By 1939, mid-1939, Carmine would be released from prison on parole. He would do his time at Sing Sing and up at Clinton in Dannemora. Keep in mind, during his prison stay, he would cross paths with Lucky Luciano. By 1940, Carmine was moving up in the world. He had developed a relationship with a longtime underboss of the Luciano crime family, Vito Genovese, and he was killing people for the mob. From what people will tell you about Carmine Galanti, he had developed a pretty severe reputation. He was a vicious guy. And at one point, the NYPD said he was involved in up to 80 murders. Let me say that again, not eight, 80. This is a guy that knew how to kill people. He was particularly scary to deal with. And I'll tell you right now, if he was walking down the street and you saw him, you might want to run the other way. At one point, Ralph Salerno, a former NYPD detective, would say, all the gangsters I met personally, and I've met dozens of them in all of my years, there were only two who, when I looked at them straight in the eye, I decided I wouldn't want them to be really personally mad at me. Neil De La Croce was one, and Carmine Galanti was the other. They had bad eyes. They had the eyes of killers. You could see how frightening they were, the frigid glare of a killer. So this is a guy that's moving up in the world through sheer viciousness, and he's getting the attention of some really powerful people. Vito Genovese was a psychopath in his own mind and in his own reputation, but this guy's making his way in the world. And Blackjack, in 1943, he would get his most important kill yet.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a few things there. I mean, first, him being compared to Neil De La Croce with his glare, it's absolutely true. I mean, we've talked about Mr. Neil a lot on this show. If you look at a photo of him, you see what we mean. He's the prototype for the street gangster. But Carmine Galanti, there is a photo of a mugshot in 1943 of him. It's got the NYPD, you know, numbers on him, 66994. And the guy's eyes just look black. I mean, he's got that thousand-yard stare that is just it's kind of chilling, right? Like it just sends a shiver down your spine. So, I mean, I think the quote there from Ralph Salerno is dead on. And yeah, 1943 would prove to be a very important year in Carmine Galanti's career.
Yeah, and what was happening was there was an individual in Italy, and he was now in America, that was really sick and tired of fascism. Keep in mind, Benito Mussolini was still in power. He was the prime minister in Italy. And there was a guy called Carlo Tresca, who ran a newspaper called Il Martello, which really was anti-fascist. And he really went at anyone that believed in fascism, including Mussolini, Joseph Stalin. He took shots at really the mafia, pretty much everybody that he didn't like. And this guy was starting to make a lot of enemies. At one point, Calvin Coolidge would lead to commute his sentence after he was given a publishing obscenities charge. This guy was definitely bothering people. Mussolini was sure sick of him, and the mob was sure sick of him as well. So what kind of happens is Vito Genovese has to go to Italy after he is involved with some murder beefs. He goes to live in Italy, and Mussolini secretly goes to him and says, I need someone to take care of this Tresco fuck. He's got to go. People were sick and tired of him. In fact, there was a guy, Frank Gallerfalo, who was the underboss to Joe Bonanno, who was also talking about him. People wanted this guy dead, and Carmine Galanti was given the contract. In 1943, Carlo Tresca is at his newspaper in Midtown Manhattan. He decides, hey, I'm going to go down and have some dinner with some of my friends. Tresca's seen crossing Fifth Avenue, 15th Street on foot when a black Ford pulls up behind him. A short, squat gunman in a brown coat jumps out and shoots Tresca in the back of the head. He falls down and the guy runs away. Now, if you know anything about Galanti, he was like 5'5", which would equate to being short, and squat. He was kind of a plump guy, a little stocky, pushing 180 pounds. So he was definitely a squat guy. This fit him perfectly. And in many books, obviously about the mob and about Carlo Tresca, multiple individuals will quote that the most likely scenario was that Tresca was killed by Carmine Galanti. This was a gigantic kill for him. And, you know, Blackjack, at the end of the day, you can't talk negatively about Mussolini and the mob. And in these days, expect nothing to happen. Keep in mind, down the road, no one would ever be charged for the Tresca murder, but it had always been purported that Galanti was the shooter.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the height of World War II here in 1943. Benito Mussolini, things are starting to turn in favor of the Allies. Mussolini clinging to power probably was had a very strong alliance with Vito Genovese. I think that that's fair to say. When Genovese fled to Italy, the stature that he brought, he was probably very close with Mussolini. And yeah, I mean, you can't say these things in public at the time that Tresca was saying and expect no repercussions. So this was probably a big move for Galanti, because you alluded before about how he became close with Genovese. You know, if Genovese needed a favor, he was going to go to Galanti, and Galanti delivered.
Yeah, and by this point, Carmine was also regularly working with Joe Bonanno. He had obviously liked Joe. They were from the same area of Italy. But things were going well for Galanti in his personal life as well. In 1945, he would marry his longtime girlfriend, Helen Marulli. Now, down the road, they would later separate. And Carmine would state that he never divorced her since he was a good Catholic. He would also live for many years with his mistress, and they would have two children. So Carmine was a busy man. He had a lot of women in his life. Wasn't a bad looking guy. Obviously, I think women like bad boys, as they say. Carmine was making inroads in his personal life, but he was also making inroads in the mob. He was killing people. He was an important part of Joe Bonanno, and obviously before that, Vito Genovese's life. In 1953, he would become his most useful self yet. In 1953, the Bonanno crime family was selling a lot of drugs. That was one thing that they were always good for, as we know later with Joe Massino and not being allowed at the commission and all that stuff. That obviously would have to do with the fact that they were always involved with drug trafficking. And in the 50s, Carmine became particularly useful for the family because he spoke multiple languages. And he could coerce with different people from France and from Italy and from Canada. And at one point, Joe Bonanno says, hey, look, I want you to go up to Montreal. I want you to deal with this group, the Catronis, who we have a relationship with. They have an organization, and they kind of deal with heroin. They have something called the French Connection. I want you to go up and deal with it. And what they basically did was they had a connection to France. They would smuggle heroin in through their connects and dole it out through the family. Carmine would spend 3 years up there and organize the operation. He would also do what he does best, murder people. And it was quoted as saying at once that he was running a up to $50 million a year gambling racket as well. So Carmine was making a lot of money, and the money started to really flow in with the drug trade. The French Connection was big business.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking $50 million a year is just, it's not real money at that point. It's play money. It's unlimited. You know, I mean, he went up to Montreal and really proved his worth. And that's, I mean, it's unbelievable how much that has to boost your stock in an organization.
And this is why when we look back and say how Carmine wasn't like a smart guy, I mean, him knowing multiple languages, him being able to deviate business plans and that kind of thing, it didn't really matter that he didn't know, you know, what holiday it was or what was going on in the world. He was pretty focused on his business and, you know, he found something he was good at. In 1957, Carmine was obviously high up in the Bonanno crime family. By this point, Bonanno was a big fan of his. He was driving for him, and he made him one of the most important people in that family, named them consigliere. Joe Bonanno and the other families were starting to feel like drugs was the way to go. And Lucky Luciano had always been someone that really back into his early years sold drugs. So in 1957, they all traveled to Palermo, to the Grand Hotel de Palms and have a meeting. And the meeting had a lot to do with setting up a new connect to smuggle heroin into the United States. And this is where the Sicilian connections would come in. Obviously, Joe, Lucky, and Carmine all had very close Sicilian connections, and they would set up a pipeline. And this made even more money for the mafia. So they were making inroads. Now, again, down the road, they would obviously anger a lot of other families because they weren't necessarily making money through drugs, but they were really on the forefront of drugs. This would get Carmine in trouble, though, Blackjack, in 1958. And then in 1960, Carmine would be indicted. He would get indicted for drug trafficking. And it's interesting because in one of the trials, the first trial, he ends up getting a mistrial because one of the jurors has, quote, a mysterious fall in abandoned building, in an abandoned building. And according to William Tendy, a U.S. attorney, he said there was, quote, no question that he was pushed. You know, Carmine Galanti continues to have like a lot of success, in all seriousness. You have to wonder, he seemed to have kind of a four-leaf clover with all this.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He seemed to have a four-leaf clover shoved up his ass. He skated on a lot of stuff that he shouldn't have skated on. You know, I mean, the juror falling down a flight of stairs is kind of comical because it's just absurd. But unfortunately for him, his luck was about to run out a little bit.
Yeah. In 1962, Carmine, though, would not escape his second trial. He would be convicted in that narcotics trial and got 20 years in prison. Keep in mind, this is kind of an interesting, weird connection, but in that trial, this had a lot to do with a heroin smuggling ring that Carmine was involved in. It was run by a guy called Big John Ormento. Ormento was part of the Lucchese crime family, and him and Carmine had a group that was smuggling heroin. They would push it through Anthony Mira and other people, including William Benvena, who was a co-defendant in this case. Benvena, as we know, Blackjack, is Billy Batts. Yep. So weirdly enough, Carmine had a connection to Billy Batts. Obviously, he knew the Lucchese's. He was connected with them through Big John Ormento. And this is kind of where it all goes down for Carmine. And keep in mind, if you remember in the film, Benvena is coming home from prison. This is what that has to do with. Benvena ends up getting 15 years. And they both go away, Carmen and him. So Carmen will go away. And I think a lot of people felt like this was kind of the end for Galante, sadly. He had kind of made some inroads, but, you know, he was 52 years old. You figure getting out, he's going to be in his mid-70s. And that was likely that. So we thought.
You would think so. You would think that a 20-year sentence for a guy at 52 is probably going to do it. But again, the four-leaf clover strikes once more.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, during all this and right before Carmine went away, it's important to mention his family. Carmine had a few kids. In fact, he had five kids. And one of his children he was particularly close with, Nina. She was, quote, the apple of his eye. And, you know, Carmine really loved her. Obviously, any father loves his kids. But Carmine obviously was a little bit different father than most. He had found out that Nina was in some sort of relationship with an individual that was not Italian. Now, Carmine believed that Nina should marry an Italian, hopefully a mobster. And it was said at one point that she had a crush on little alley boy Persico. So what does Carmine do? He goes to this guy that Nina's dating and sends some people after him. Nina is so distraught, she attempts suicide. She had a very poor relationship by this point with her father. And it's sad because sometimes, as we've said before, with people like Roy DeMeo, the kids are the ones that really suffer. And Nina just wanted to live her life, but she loved their dad. Once Carmine goes away, quote, they have kind of rekindling of their relationship. And when Carmine comes home in 1974, Nina is his driver. She actually becomes part of his criminal life. And I mentioned the connection with little alley boy Persico. Carmine Persico and Galanti had a relationship, and they were kind of setting up Blackjack, a matchmaker type of thing, where little alley boy and Nina would marry. They would develop the new Janice Soprano, Richie Aprile connection, and they would make all sorts of little mafia children. It didn't end up working out, but at one point, and this has been proven, Carmine actually proposed that Nina be made. He actually really wanted his daughter, who was a Spitfire, to be inducted into the Bonanno crime family. It didn't end up working out, but an interesting kind of tidbit, she would have been the first female member. Now, remember, there were females involved with the mob. Obviously, if you know anything about Bugsy Siegel, Virginia Hill was involved, and there were people like Stephanie St. Clair, who was a Black numbers runner, but there was no actual female mobsters in America. No. And it didn't end up working with Carmine, but it was fascinating to think about, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing makes sense, right? I mean, Persico, we know, loved to consolidate within the family, so it makes sense from his perspective. You know, Galanti would gain a significant ally in Persico. And then as far as trying to have his daughter made, I mean, listen, we've talked about it with guys top to bottom, that they try to keep things within their own families. He obviously was closest with his daughter and trusted her the most. An interesting move, to be sure. I mean, she would have made history as the first American woman to be made in the American mafia, but 'twas not to be.
A fucking woman boss. That's what, if you remember, Tony said that in season two. So Carmine's out, and he gets right back to his devious behavior. Once he gets released, he orders the bombing of the doors of a mausoleum on Frank Costello's memorial. Keep in mind, Frank Costello died a year before. Carmine couldn't kill him again, so he decides, fuck this guy. He was mad at Frank because of he thought Frank had a lot to do with Vito Genovese and his legal issues. And, you know, he just didn't like Frank Costello. So Carmine orders that the doors on the mausoleum be blown out, which is a pretty wild move, but it really showed the machismo of our friend Carmine. In 1974, it's important to kind of understand, by this point, the Bonanno crime family was pretty much out of control. They really had struggled to find a lack thereof of leadership, and they were kind of a rudderless ship. And we talked about this during the Joe Massino episode. The boss at the time, once Joe Bonanno goes away, because keep in mind, in 1968, Joe Bonanno forcefully is replaced. He has some really wild behavior that we'll talk about in an episode down the road. And after that, there's kind of a couple different bosses. Paul Siaka was the boss at one point, and then Natalie Evola becomes boss. And in 1973, he dies. In 74, Philip Rastelli takes over, Rusty. Problem is, in 1976, he goes away. And this is where Galanti feels like, I can find my way to become the boss. And he becomes an unofficial acting boss. So this was all he'd wanted. He had started as just a hijacker, if you will. He's made his way all the way to the boss of a major American family. And he ran it with an iron fist.
I mean, yeah, he ran roughshod. I mean, he really kind of, as we're going to talk about here, went off the reservation in a way that nobody else in history has. You know, he went out, as you said, bombing the doors off of Frank Costello's mausoleum is a bizarre move. he develops a feud with the Gambino family and kills 8 members of that family. I mean, he really just went a little crazy here.
Yeah, what happens was, so he takes control and he starts going right back to selling drugs. And as we know with the Gambinos and with other families, they didn't want that to go on. He kind of says, I'm going to do what I want to do. The Gambinos, some of the members start trying to muscle in. He just starts killing people. He's also not sharing any of the proceeds that he's making. And he was reportedly at one point making millions of dollars per day, which is really wild to think about. The thing about Carmine that makes him so fascinating is we've talked about, to be one of these like all-time mobsters, you have to obviously earn and you obviously have to be violent. Carmine surely was both. He made a whole hell of a lot of money. And Carmine got to a point where he became almost brash, arrogant, you know, just no one's going to do anything to me. I'm going to do what the fuck I want, when I want, and you're not going to do anything about it. He reportedly would roam the streets of Little Italy like a, quote, aristocrat. And everyone started to take notice. And slowly but surely, the commission starts to catch wind of this. The commission starts to see what's going on. And they already had been sick of the Bananas for selling drugs. But people like Corallo and Salerno and Castellano and all these guys, they started to take notice that, as we know, the Bananas are a rudderless ship. At one point, Lieutenant Remo Francini, head of the criminal intelligence section of the organized crime group of the NYPD, would say, not since the days of Vito Genovese has there been a more ruthless and feared individual. When it comes to Galante, the rest of them are copper. He is pure steel. So he was making a reputation with everyone, all the way back to his younger days. Carmine was dangerous, but now he was truly feared because he was a guy that didn't give a fuck and he didn't worry about power grabs. He believed that no one was going to do anything to him. And after a 1977 New York Times expose, Carmine would become so confident in his power that he wouldn't carry a gun. He would literally walk the streets and say, no one is ever going to kill me. They wouldn't dare. If they want to call me boss of all bosses, that's all right. Between you and me, all I do is grow tomatoes. So he's truly saying, fuck you, Gambino. Fuck you, Castellano. Fuck all of you. I'm not part of any of this. I run this shit, and you're not going to do anything about it.
Yeah, it's a bold move, Jeff. It's a bold move. We've never talked about a guy who has really gone rogue like this. You know, to be so cocky and so arrogant as to basically accept the mantra of boss of bosses, which, let's be honest, he wasn't, and not carry a gun and just dare people to come and get you, it's a level of arrogance that even John Gotti would be envious of.
Yeah, he became just out of control. And as we know, and as you eloquently said, there's really been no one that is kind of, you know, you have power grabs and things of that nature, but no one has become this kind of just
reckless.
Yeah. I mean, he was completely out of control. He was jumping in with both feet, if you will. He had no real issue with doing what he wanted. And as we know, the commission at this point was the most powerful crime group in America, and they truly ran everything. They ran it like a board of directors, and they weren't going to allow this to continue for too long. In fact, at one point, the commission decides Carmine's got to go. Okay, he's done. He's not sharing in his proceeds. He's completely on his own. He's off the reservation. He's killing people without consent. And even in fact, it was reported that Joe Bonanno, behind Carmine's back, actually consented. Joe Bonanno, in retirement, had even said, this guy is completely fucking everything up. He's got to go. And that was pretty much that. So we'll kind of go into how this all goes down. On July 12th, 1979, Carmine decides that he's going to go have lunch at one of his favorite restaurants, Joe and Mary's. It was an Italian restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It was owned by his cousin, Joe Tirano. Joe was a soldier in the Bonanno family, and people really liked Joe and Mary's. They had great food. And he would attend a meeting and a lunch with one of his capos, Leonard Coppola, and another individual as well, who was a soldier in the family. They would walk in, they'd go to the back courtyard, which is open. And by this point, Carmine had two bodyguards, Baldo Amato and Cesar Bonaventure. They would kind of stand guard just off the table in the walkway. And it would be really difficult to obviously do anything. Now, keep in mind, Carmine was a tough guy, but he still did have bodyguards. And it kind of went down. At 2:45, three ski-masked men would enter the building and basically take out Galanti and not only Coppola, but Toronto as well. And I want to kind of go into who was involved here. The shooter of Galanti was an individual called Russell Morrow. Morrow was a member of the family, and he was someone that would participate in murders. He was tasked with that piece of work. Sonny Redden Delicato's son Bruno would shoot Toronto and Coppola. And the other individual involved was Dominic Big Trin Trinchera. Obviously, Trinchera would be killed years later in the Three Capos hit, but he would stand guard kind of inside the hallway. Now, one thing we're not talking about here is why did the Zip bodyguards not do anything here? And that would lend us to believe that they had become traitors to Carmine Galanti. Look, I think the truth of the matter was Galanti was on a fucking island. Even his longtime friends, Joe Bonanno and Bonaventure and Amato, no one could stick up for this guy anymore. And you're not going to second guess the commission. So I think Bonaventure and Amato just got in line and said, we're in on this. That'll be that. Now, the driver of the car was Santo Giordano, the getaway car. And in the backup crash car was Joe Massino, Sonny Redden Delicato, JB and Delicato, and Phil Lucky Giacconi. These were all the folks involved with this. Look, when you do hits of this nature, and we talked about it with the Castellano hit, this isn't some associate on the street. This is a high-value target, and you've got to take all necessary precautions. And it's regarded, frankly, Blackjack, as you know, and I know you're going to talk about the picture, this is one of the most famous homicides in the history of the mob.
It is, without any question. It's Carmine Galanti and Paul Castellano are up there as 1 and 1A. The bodyguards had to be in on it, because if you're thinking about this logically, right, if you're planning a hit and you know he's got two bodyguards, you know Galanti doesn't carry a gun. You know the bodyguards are packing. The first thing you're doing when you hit that courtyard is taking the bodyguards out, right? That's the first thing you're going to do. Not one shot was fired at either bodyguard. These guys knew the bodyguards are just going to stand there and do nothing. They knew it. Otherwise, you take them out first. Then you go to the unarmed guy. That's not what happened. So obviously, the bodyguards were in on this, which, as you said, is no surprise because he had to go and everyone knew it. The picture, which you alluded to, is, in my mind, the most iconic photo in the history of mafia killings. Carmine Galanti, as you said at the top of the episode, his nickname was Lilo, which is Italian for cigar. Always had a cigar in his mouth, including the moment he died. He sprawled out on the concrete in the courtyard with his white shirt on and a cigar in his mouth and blood everywhere. It's a gruesome photo. It's very graphic, but it is Carmine Galanti to a T.
Yeah, and, you know, this ended up being a pretty important piece of history because this would be one of the real smoking guns for the federal government in the commission case. And interestingly enough, about an hour after this happens, Indelicato is seen on video surveillance outside a social club. You know, kind of they're almost celebrating this. And this would end up being a pretty important part of that case. And Delicato would end up getting a long prison term for this hit. And this would be one of the things that they kind of connected the commission to making decisions on. They had to kind of connect them all over something. And this was one of them. So this ended up being kind of a pretty important hit in the grand scheme of things. It would end up ultimately really being the end for the five families and for the mafia really in general. I did want to bring up one interesting part of the lunch. One individual that we didn't talk about was a guy called Angelo Presenzano. He was a soldier in the Bonanno crime family. And he actually, Blackjack, was at this lunch, but would leave early due to a stomach ache.
Yeah, I mean, or that could be an air quote stomach ache. It could be he knew what was coming.
That's true. And I guess, you know, we'll never know. He would, weirdly enough, though, die in 1979. And there's not a lot known about his death, but kind of weird, kind of a weird situation. Ultimately, though, Galanti was dead, and that was that. And you'd really expected it. It was bound to happen. The Bonanno crime family had kind of done its own thing. But again, this is a family that you're not going to spit at the commission and expect nothing to happen. Now, down the road, Joseph Messina would take over this family years later, about 12 years later. It would kind of turn the family around just a little bit. But this was a publicized hit. I urge you, if you've never seen the picture, go take a look at it. It is a fascinating shot. After the fact, the Catholic Church in New York would refuse a funeral, as they generally do. Carmine is buried in Middle Village, Queens. Keep in mind, Cesar Bonaventure in 1984 was found dead in a New Jersey warehouse. And according to reports, he was killed to guarantee his silence. Keep in mind, by this point, the commission trial was happening. You know, they wanted to make sure he didn't say anything. So that's that. Carmine Galanti, a guy that really had signed his own death wish when he got out of prison. He went off completely with 2 feet. I don't know why he did it. He was making a ton of money, but he wanted to be powerful. The only problem is he didn't want to play well with others. And, you know, when you do that in the mafia, you're going to have a violent end.
Yeah, and he certainly did. I mean, like we said, Jeff, we've never talked about a guy who went rogue in the fashion that he did. He spit in the face of not only his own family, but all of the other families as well. He launched a personal war with Carlo Gambino, who, as we said in the Gambino episode, who didn't like Carlo Gambino? I mean, Carmine Galanti was the answer. It's just the guy really, he reaped what he sowed.
100%. And, you know, I think when we look back at Galanti, I think we all knew, especially if you know the history on this guy, really from his 20s, I think it was pretty clear he was a psychopath. Prison documents would prove that. And, you know, I think he's a guy that obviously is not real different than most of the other people that we talk about, but he is truly on his own when it comes to shooting the police, when it involves killing people. I mean, I know that we want to talk about Casso and Patera and DeMeo and guys like that, but I got to be honest, in his heyday, there ain't nobody I'm picking over Carmine Galanti. It's that simple. This guy also made a ton of money. He made inroads. As far as drug trafficking, you've got to think he's the highest level of drug traffickers in the history of the mob. Obviously, the mob didn't like drugs, but
sure.
I don't know if there's someone that did it better than Carmine Galanti.
Yeah, I mean, he's right up there in drug trafficking. And as far as his reputation as a killer, I mean, like you said, 80 murders to his credit. That makes him not only one of the most prolific mobsters of all time, but one of the most prolific killers in American history. There's not many people with a higher body count to their name than Carmine Galanti.
No. And we'll never know truly how many people he killed. But again, he was just a one-man operation. And you always got to wonder, Blackjack, if we go back to the time when he shot at the cop and the six-year-old, you have to wonder. That was 30, 40 years later. We may have never seen Carmine Galanti again.
100%. 100%.
Pretty fascinating. Just goes to show you that if you were out in the 30s and 40s, you could have pretty much did whatever you wanted. As long as you weren't truly seen on by someone doing it, you would have got away with it. It's that simple.
That's right.
Another great show, another sit down. Carmine Galanti. That was what I've been wanting to do. I think Carmine's fascinating. Definitely signed his own death warrant, though. Next week, we will talk about the other frigid stare killer. Neil Delacroce. I know you've been wanting to get into this one. There's no one that likes Neil Delacroce more than Blackjack Fletcher.
True.
Would you say this is your favorite gangster?
I think it might be. Yeah. I love Mr. Neal. I could talk about Mr. Neal all night.
Yeah. And you definitely love him. Not surely for sure, but we'll get into him next week on the show. So expect that. We'll also probably do a Q&A next week. So if you have any comments or questions, we've been getting some really good ones. Obviously we didn't do it this week, but we've been getting some really good ones. And I really want to thank everyone for their support. It means a lot to me. It means the utmost to me. We started this show and again, we really didn't know what to expect, but we continue to make major inroads and we continue to have a great time doing it. As we wrap up the show, and I kind of wanted to wait to the end to talk about this because I know you're all waiting with bated breath. I want to tell you about Omerta Clothing. We have to tell you about that before we go. I highly urge you, if you enjoy the mob, you enjoy mafia clothing, go check out Omerta Clothing, omertamia.com, omertamia.com. You've seen me wearing the Stop Glorifying Rats, the Fun Police Informants, the logo, Omerta shirt. All that stuff can be found on the website. It's truly great material. They've got some great hats, stickers, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, t-shirts, whatever you want. Omerta Mia has you covered. And I know, Black Chick, you really like Omerta Mia.
I love it. They make great stuff. It's quality clothing. And, you know, I mean, my favorite is the Defund Police Informants. Defund Police was kind of a hot button thing about a year ago. And Defund Police Informants is something near and dear to my heart as a defense attorney. I despise informants. And I think we cut deals with people that are often far worse than the ones we're using them to prosecute. So I'm all about defunding police informants. So I love that shirt in particular.
Yeah, go check it out. And by listening to the show, we're going to give you a little discount. Go buy some stuff now and you sit down 20 at checkout, code sit down 20 at checkout. And you're going to get yourself 20% off your entire order. So support the show, support us, support them, get yourself some gear and, you know, look cool. I see all sorts of cool people wearing these shirts now, including me. So get in the game now, omertamia.com, code sit down 20. You know, go show love because they show love to us. And as I said, next week, Neal Delacroce on the show. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at the sit down 7. And if you come across the show on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you get it, make sure you leave us a comment, leave us a 5-star rating. We keep on keeping on. Thanks as always, Black Chick. We'll talk to you next week. And we thank you for listening here on the sit down.